Now, our first guest today tells how a leading writer of the Lost Generation became America's most famous farmer and inspired the organic food movement. Here to tell us about his book called The Planter of Modern Life, Louis Bromfield and the Seeds of a Food Revolution, welcome Stephen Hayman.
Hi there. I'm very happy to be with you.
Thanks for joining us, Stephen. Now, I want to go through the book and who he was, etc. But first of all, doing my research, I found it amazing that such an important historical man has not had more written about him. Is that why you decided to write this book?
Absolutely. Yeah, Bromfield is a kind of strange figure in that he was in the margins of both environmental history and literary history, though he had been extremely famous in his time. No one had kind of connected the different pieces of his legacy. And when I discovered him, which was about 5 years ago, I was talking to a lamb farmer who had himself been inspired to get into agriculture from reading Bromfield's books. I had never heard of him. And I did some cursory research, and I fell down this marvelous rabbit hole and discovered a really unique personality who, despite this fantastic life that he led, was kind of banished from popular memory.
Yeah, incredible life, incredible story. So it started, I believe, he was a World War I ambulance driver.
That's correct. Like a lot of future American writers, Bromfield volunteered to be an ambulance driver in World War I before America had joined the war. And that experience was very important for him because it brought him in touch with France. And he served on the Western Front. He was attached to the French army. He discovered French culture, French language, and French agriculture. And he was very taken with this whole concept of terroir, of this almost sacred approach to the land. When he came back to France in the 1920s, again, with a lot of other American writers, this was the kind of Lost Generation moment. He didn't rent a garret on the Left Bank, but instead settled in a provincial town outside of Paris called Senlis, where he built this magnificent garden on a river. And the garden became a kind of literary salon between the wars. Gertrude Stein and Edith Wharton and a lot of other writers, but not only writers, all types of people were attracted to his garden.
Yeah, he didn't seem to follow the fame and fortune. I mean, he was actually as famous in the 20s as Hemingway, but he just seemed to want to be a gardener, didn't he?
Well, and people actually were a little suspicious of this tendency because he was this extremely successful novelist, but when you went to his house, he didn't want to talk about literature. He wanted to talk about his dahlias and his roses. They thought that he was kind of putting on airs. But the truth is, he was more passionate about the soil than he was about any of his books, although it took him, several decades to find his way back to the land entirely. It wasn't until 1938 that he moved back to Ohio and decided to really make a go of it as a farmer.
So before then, Stephen, how did he go from being an ambulance driver to a writer? Or was he a writer anyway, but obviously did his stint during the war?
Yeah, I mean, he had been raised by a mother who kind of resented her own farming background and craved culture and wanted him to become a famous writer. And she kind of force-fed him, serious novels and set his course in a way. But he loved his grandfather's farm growing up in rural Ohio. And so there's this kind of original tension between him. He published his first novel in 1924, The Green Bay Tree. His third book, Early Autumn, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1927. And at this period, he was very devoted to his craft. His novels seem today you know, when compared to the work of Ernest Hemingway, for instance, a tad old-fashioned in a kind of post-Victorian mold. But they gave pleasure to millions of readers all around the world. They were translated into many, many languages. But you asked a very good question, which is his transition from writer to agriculturalist. So, as I mentioned, he has this garden, which is also a kind of literary salon, and he's becoming more absorbed in gardening. But this is in the 1930s, when a lot of bad things are happening in the world. And as he's sitting in his garden, having tea with Edith Wharton and admiring the roses, he's also reading accounts of things like the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. And he's reading about how American farmers are being dispossessed of their land by the millions, and how harmful farming practices are leading to along with the terrible droughts in the Great Plains, leading to these gigantic dust storms, huge events of soil erosion, and it's heartbreaking to him. And around this time, he travels to India, and he links up with a man named Albert Howard, who is considered to be the founding father of the organic movement. And he learns some ideas from Howard. And then in 1938, after the Munich conference, Bromfield sees the direction that things are headed in Europe. He decides that he wants to go home, to go back to his native Ohio, to raise his children on an honest-to-God farm, as he calls it. And he buys 600 acres not far from his native town of Mansfield.
So, just going back to, you said he was talking about the world and the way things were going. Did he get involved in the political side of it then?
Yes. So as much as Bromfield craved this kind of intimate connection with the earth, and as much as he was disgusted by Chamberlain's appeasement, he was very engaged with what was happening. He was always writing political columns. He worked along with a lot of other expatriates in Paris in that period to rescue and repatriate American volunteers in the Spanish Civil War. So he was very politically engaged, and that continued in his American years after he came back. But he also craved a certain kind of self-sufficiency for his family, seeing all of the terrible uncertainty that came out of the Depression years and all the political instability of the period. So he wanted to make his farm. He was inspired by the fortress manor of France, as he called it, and he wanted to make his farm a kind of a thrifty island of self-sufficiency. What it became was something quite different, actually.
Right. And we said earlier that he wasn't necessarily interested in the glitz and glamour of Hollywood. But like you mentioned, Edith Wharton, he had quite a lot of high society people over to his 600 acres, including Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall.
Well, that's right. Wharton was a friend from the French period. But in terms of Bogart and Bacall, after he sets up his farm in 1938, he builds this very elaborate 19-room Greek Revival manor house. And he calls the farm Malabar. He gives it an Indian name because it was inspired because it was financed with the profits from one of his best-selling novels, The Rains Came, which was made into a 1939 blockbuster film. And it's not so much that Bromfield didn't like the glitz and glamour. I mean, he spent a lot of time in Hollywood. He hung out in famous New York nightclubs. He spent time in lots of different, traveling in lots of different society circles, but then he came back to the farm. So there was this, he once joked that his life was split between nightclubs and manure piles. And so he really did have that duality. And so he was a screenwriter in Hollywood. That's how he raised all the money for all of his various agricultural experiments. And he became friendly with Humphrey Bogart. And Bogart used to visit the farm with his third wife, Mayo Matheau. But Bogart had a troubled marriage, and he began work on a film. Now we're in the 1944, the last years of the war, 1945. He began working on a film which connected him with Lauren Bacall, a very young actress, a very beautiful actress. And they fell in love, and Bogart got divorced. And Bacall and Bogart chose to get married on Bromfield, Ohio farm. And it came as it was very confusing to the Hollywood press at the time. They were like, why is this Hollywood couple deciding to get married and, you know, in the middle of nowhere? But Bromfield had enough charisma that he could bring people like Bogart and Bacall, you know, to rural Ohio to get married.
I can just see them getting married on a farm in their Wellingtons. Interesting. So onto the agricultural side. So this farm that he set up, because he was inspirational in the organic movement, was it sort of an experimental farm?
Yes. So he pioneered a lot of things. Well, let me give you a little bit of background. Basically, Bromfield, as I mentioned, you know, came out of Europe at a moment when it was when basically on the eve of World War II, and he was looking for self sufficiency, and he had a kind of romantic idea of what his farm would be like. That he wanted to kind of live the agrarian lifestyle of his grandparents. So he found some land in a very romantic valley in Ohio. Called Pleasant Valley, but the valley was covered in snow. So he was not really able to look at the condition of the land. And I think in a bout of excitement, he just basically bought it. And then when the snow melted in the spring of 1939, he realized that his land was essentially worthless, that all of the sandy, loose, alluvial topsoil had been washed out off the hills. And there were these deep gullies from erosion. And his farm was basically in the same position of a lot of American farms at the time. So Bromfield begins to transform the land, and in the process, he kind of transforms himself. And a lot of the techniques that he pioneered there, which are things like contour plowing and using cover crops and intercropping a host of different techniques that are essentially the bedrock of sustainable agriculture today, but at the time they were very new. And Bromfield used his farm to essentially demonstrate them, and he wrote about them in his books, and thousands of people came to Malabar to visit. And so even today among organic farmers, it is an important kind of pilgrimage site.
Yeah, of course. And I believe he became first vice president of the Friends of the Land Association as well.
That's right. That's a remarkable organization that has been almost entirely forgotten. But this was a group of Americans from all walks of life that got together on the eve of World War II to try to correct the country's relationship with the land, which had led to things like the Dust Bowl and all these terrible soil erosion events. And they succeeded remarkably in kind of spreading the message of conservation. Obviously, they were up against, agriculture ultimately took a different path, but their work has been inspirational to successive generations of regenerative farmers who are trying even today to improve our relationship with the land.
And was he able to sustain all this, Stephen? Because maintaining a farm like that must be quite costly.
Yes, so Malabar lost money every year it was in existence. I mean, but it was not a kind of vanity project, or at least Bromfield conceived of it as a serious commercial enterprise, and he wanted to test his ideas at scale. The problem was that he was always experimenting. He was always trying out new gadgets and investing all of his money in these things. And he also lived a very lavish lifestyle. He was known for his hospitality. He threw great parties and had barn dances every weekend. And as his literary career faltered, because he had used his Hollywood screenwriting and his successful novels to essentially pay for the agricultural enterprise. But in the 1950s, his literary standing kind of eroded, and he didn't have the money to basically support Malabar any longer, and he went into debt. And the farm was eventually rescued in part through the generosity of the American tobacco heiress, Doris Duke, who is known for her philanthropy and her horticultural pursuits and her eccentric lifestyle. But she, after Bromfield's wife died, she and Bromfield had a love affair. This was in the mid-1950s, shortly before his death. Malabar was a very questionably successful commercial enterprise, though it later inspired all these farmers. But Bromfield's charisma once again kind of saved him by connecting him with this benefactor, Doris Duke. Mm.
Well, he certainly did leave a legacy, didn't he? People can hear more by reading the book. It's called The Planter of Modern Life, Louis Bromfield and the Seeds of a Food Revolution. It's by Stephen Heyman, who we're speaking to now, and you can buy it right now from our website. Stephen, do you have a website as well if people want to find out more?
Oh, yes. It's just my my first name, Stephen with a PH, Heyman.com.
StephenHeyman.com. Well, thank you so much for telling us a bit more about Louis Bromfield, and thank you for being on the show.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.